Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
When the Vietnam War ended, Americans who had answered their country's call to fight found themselves returning to a society that sometimes vented their disgust with the war itself on the men who had fought it. It's no surprise that some of those traumatized soldiers struggled to reintegrate. But we've grown more sensitive since then, and many people are quick to thank returning veterans today for their service. So why do so many still find themselves adrift when they return from combat deployments? This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Journalist Sebastian Junger spent many long years of his career in conflict zones, and he's come to the conclusion that for all its dangers and discomforts, platoon life offers members some benefits, too, a kind of communal connection that can be very hard to duplicate in modern civilian life, not only for military professionals, but for all of us. Sebastian Junger is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair. His new book is called Tribe, on homecoming and belonging. Sebastian, welcome back to Think.
Thank you very much.
You open this book with a really beautiful story from the time that you spent backpacking after college. From a distance, you realized you were being followed by a guy who looked hard up.
Yeah, I was on a highway right outside Gillette, Wyoming. I wasn't backpacking. I was actually hitchhiking across the country.
Hitchhiking.
I grew up in Boston. I'd never been west of the Hudson River, and I wanted to see this great country. And it was late fall. It was cold. I was getting beer bottles thrown at me. It was not a very friendly place outside Gillette, Wyoming in 1986, I think it was. And I saw this guy coming towards me from town up the on-ramp. He looked terrible. He was a big guy, had really tattered clothing and sort of matted hair, and he just clearly was not living well. And I had a backpack with camping gear in it and, you know, food and everything. I'd saved up my money, and I was taking this trip. And he came up to me and he said, "Hey, where are you going?" And I said, "I'm going to California." And he said, "You got any food?" Now, I'd give food to anyone who was hungry, but I didn't think that's what was going on. I thought he wanted me to get my open my backpack up and he would rob me. That's what I thought. Mm-hmm. So I was very defensive. I said, "I got a little cheese, you know." And he looked at me. He was carrying a lunchbox. And back when people had lunchboxes, right? And he looked at me. He said, "You can't get to California on a little cheese." He said, I live in a car in town. I don't have a home. I live in a car in town. I walk 3 miles every morning out to the coal mine outside of Gillette to see if anyone's sick, maybe, you know, see if I can get work for the day. And today nobody's sick, so I can't work, so I won't be needing this." And he opened up his lunchbox. He said, "I want you to have this to help you get to California." And I still remember what the lunch was. It was a bologna sandwich and an apple and a bag of potato chips. And he'd probably gotten it from one of the local churches that were giving out food to the needy. Of course, I protested, and but he wouldn't hear of it, and I took his lunch. But I got much more than a lunch from him. I got, really a whole lifetime of thinking about not just what generosity is. That was generosity. A lot of people are generous, though. He'd taken responsibility for me. He'd seen me from town, and he'd worried about me. And he had seen, I think, we had some common bond, even though we didn't know each other. In his mind, I have to imagine that he felt that because he took responsibility for me and he walked half a mile out of highway to make sure I was okay. And that's the beginning of my book, Tribe, and which really talks about, you know, what is it that we all owe each other? How do we, what's it mean to all belong to a community? And is this whole nation one big community? And if so, why are we so troubled and so conflicted within it?
You know, I was thinking about your story and even the fact that people might hear that today and say, "Well, I would not have eaten that lunch. What if you put something in it?" You know, we have our backs up so much even against people who are, in fact, reaching out and trying to be part of our tribe.
Yes, that's true. I think people who wouldn't eat the lunch probably don't need it.
As early as the 18th century, people of European descent were known to be drawn to the lifestyles of native peoples that they encountered in the Americas, so much so that white people occasionally, like, ensconced themselves with local tribes, but it did not happen the other way around.
Yeah, I found a wonderful letter by Benjamin Franklin that he'd written to a friend in the 1750s, I think, and he'd said, you know, this was a matter of some consternation for this good Christian society that was taking place on the East Coast of the United States at that time. And he wrote, he said, thousands of white people, I think that's what he called them, thousands of white people have run off to join the Indians. But we don't have one example of an Indian who's run off to join us. And he goes on to sort of wonder, you know, what is it about civilization that's so unappealing, even to people who benefit from its wealth and its safety? And that actually came back to me when I started to encounter this strange phenomenon in soldiers that I knew. You know, I spent a year off and on at a remote outpost called Restrepo in eastern Afghanistan. I made a movie by that name with my late colleague and friend Tim Hetherington. And those guys were stuck on a ridge for a year, 20-man position, you know, sleeping in the dirt, fighting almost every day. I mean, it was brutal, right? And after it was all over, many of them didn't want to go home. Once they flew back to Italy, they wanted to go back to it. Reminded me of what Benjamin Franklin was saying, like nobody wants to come back to civilization. People go native. We have a phrase to go native. We don't have a phrase to go civilized. And what does that say about modern society for all of its wonderful benefits? What does it say about our natural human predispositions and the society that we've created?
So, you know, you describe these uncomfortable positions at Restrepo. People are in danger. They're on a combat mission. They're uncomfortable. They're cut off from pretty much any form of recreation. They're bound to one another by something as simple as the fact that they sleep in the same room. And you experienced a strange kind of sense that you were safe, even though, you know, by any account, you were in a place where you could be killed at any minute.
Yeah, I studied anthropology in college, and I sort of see everything through that lens to some degree. And in fact, most human societies throughout most of history have had people sleep together, extended families, whole groups of people sleeping in the same space. So, of course, that means that if you're a child, unlike in this society, you don't sleep in your own room by yourself. That's terrifying to an infant. I mean, we're primates. Baby primates are in grave danger if they're by themselves. And instinctively, I think human infants know that. And that's why they're so troubled when they're stuck in a room by themselves to go to sleep. But even for adults, I mean, the security of being surrounded by people that you know and trust in the middle of the night in a dangerous place is incredible. And I really have to say I felt safer surrounded by those guys in one of the most intense war zones in Afghanistan. I mean, the Korangal Valley was the scene of an enormous amount of fighting when I was there. I felt safer with those guys than on the many, many times that I went camping by myself in New England, where there was really zero threat to my life. But just being alone in the woods is something that humans are really wired to not like, that you do not want to do that. We know it's extremely dangerous. Intuitively, we know that.
So, Sebastian, how did we form this culture that has, I mean, there's no other word than reverence for rugged individualism?
Well, you know, any tribal society, and in my book, I look at the American Indians, I look at the Kung of the Kalahari, I look at our hominid ancestors, any group of humans relies on rugged individuals to do their thing exceptionally well. There are great hunters. There are great orators. There are great bow and arrow makers. I mean, whatever. I mean, society needs specialization. The point is that those great skills and that sort of individualized energy for most of human history has been applied towards the common good. We evolved to live, to survive in groups of 40, 50 individuals. That's what humans have done for hundreds of thousands of years. And there is no individual survival without group survival. There are no individual interests that exist separately from group interests. They're the same thing. I mean, that's what we're and I'm not calling to radically reform society. I know it probably sounds a lot like communism to some people. All I'm saying is that we evolved in a certain way to really share just about everything in a pretty egalitarian society. And we've departed from that. And whether that's right or wrong is not for me, a journalist, to decide. But what I can do is document the psychological or the human costs to living outside of hundreds of thousands of years of human evolution.
How does growing affluence, and, you know, we can note here that growing affluence is something that, that only a fraction of our society has, but how does growing affluence tend to change the things that people want and the things that people work for?
Well, ironically, I started with this sort of thesis, like maybe the PTSD, the rates of PTSD that soldiers experience isn't determined by the intensity of the trauma so much as by the level of alienation or cohesion of the society they return to. Hmm. And I thought, okay, if that's true, and indeed it turned out to be true, and we can get into that if you like, but if that's true, I said to myself, I bet other rates of mental illness are also elevated in alienated, fractured societies, Western society, basically. And indeed, that's the case. I mean, I was shocked to see this. Ironically, as affluence goes up in a society, the suicide rate tends to go up. The rate of depression tends to go up. Even something like schizophrenia goes up with urbanization. And so you have this... We have this sort of human conundrum. I mean, modern society is an enormous blessing. And so, I mean, I said surgery a couple of months ago. I mean, thank God for modern society. You know, but you know, before that, you went under the knife, you know, without anesthesia. And many, many other blessings. And, of course, we understand that. But there is a kind of human toll to living in industrialized mass society. And we have to understand that in order to take better care of ourselves. And I think there is a, frankly, a sort of dangerous dissolution of our group affiliation, our group bond within this country, probably in many countries, you know, politically right now, you know, sort of coming out politically, that I think really goes a little bit back to some of the stuff that I'm writing about in Tribe.
So we place importance on wealth and status at the expense of meaning, and we pay for it with a lifetime of malaise and ennui?
Well, according to the statistics, yes, we do. that's all I can give you is statistics. I mean, these are difficult things to measure. It's hard to measure human happiness. It's a lot easier to measure mental illness, of course. It's very easy to measure suicide rates. One thing that interested me was what happens to modern societies when they collapse? What happened or contract? What happens, you know, in London during the Blitz, when all of a sudden Londoners are sleeping shoulder to shoulder with strangers on subway platforms and getting bombed? 30,000 Londoners were killed during the Blitz. They weren't quite bombed back to the Stone Age, but kind of halfway there. What happened? Well, you did not get mayhem. You got the opposite of mayhem. You got a community, a society coming together. As one official said, we have neurotics driving ambulances. Another woman said, you know, we would have all gone down to the beaches with broken bottles to fight the Germans if we'd had to. And the effect on mental health is extraordinary. The authorities were prepared for mass psychiatric casualties, not just physical casualties. Of course, they had those. But mass psychiatric casualties. And in fact, what happened was that admissions to psychiatric wards went down during the bombings. It seemed to the stress and the adversity seemed in some ways to help people.
We're speaking this hour with journalist Sebastian Junger about his new book, Tribe, on homecoming and belonging. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can tweet us at KERA Think, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Sebastian Junger about his new book, Tribe, on homecoming and belonging. Join us by tweeting us at KERA Think, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. Sebastian, tribal cultures all over the world, certainly those in North America, have occasionally had a history of conflict with other tribes. Certainly we know that some young men in those societies were raised to be warriors and would have experienced great trauma. What did you learn about the manifestations of trauma among people who came back from war in traditional tribal cultures?
Well, I really looked high and low for accounts of what we now call PTSD in ethnographies, in the anthropological literature. I interviewed, 20, 25 anthropologists who've worked all over the world in the current day. and I really just couldn't find anything. I mean, it was really interesting. I found one really interesting study in Nepal. Now, of course, this is a current day war. There's a Maoist insurgency, and there's been combat there for about 10 years. And one anthropologist said that if you take child soldiers who fought and they go back to a unified and cohesive village, and there are certain kinds of villages that were typified by that. They were multi-ethnic and multi-religious. That within a year, that child soldier psychologically was indistinguishable from his peers who didn't fight, who weren't traumatized. If you take that same kind of child soldier and send him to a much more alienating and a socially stratified village that was just had one religion, Hinduism, that after a year, their trauma symptoms had hardly dissipated. And so what I conclude with some other data too is that basically if you return to a close cohesive society of the sort that we evolved for and existed in for hundreds of thousands of years, you of course have a trauma an initial trauma reaction if your life's been put in danger. That's natural, it's adaptive, but it's pretty transitory. But long-term chronic trauma doesn't seem to happen in really close cohesive societies, even in Israel, which of course is a modern country. They still have enough of a, I want to say a sort of tribal ethos in the sense that everyone serves in the military. Everyone is extremely familiar with the sort of war on their doorstep. In kibbutzes around the country, the sort of unity in those settlements are very, very sort of fortifying of psychological health. And whatever you want to say about the politics of all that, the PTSD rate in soldiers is around 1%. In the U.S. military, the diagnosed PTSD rate is around 20%. And around 50% of the military has applied for some form of PTSD disability.
And notably, many of those individuals who say that they're experiencing PTSD symptoms were not assigned to combat units.
Yes, and that's a sort of puzzling thing that I think eventually makes sense. Around 10% of the military actively engages in combat. Some other percentage might wind up in a traumatic situation because war is war. But it doesn't come close to the 50% that have applied for disability. So what do you do with that 40% that really wasn't traumatized, but they come home and they feel really in a kind of psychological danger? What is going on? And I think what it is that the word that everyone has for their troubles is PTSD. But for the people who actually weren't traumatized, they're experiencing a really difficult transition from a tribal environment in their platoon where they're sleeping just like the Londoners. They're sleeping shoulder to shoulder in a small space. They're taking meals together, doing tasks and missions together. 30, 40 people in a platoon, you spend a year like that. I mean, at Restrepo, I was never out of arm's length from another guy. I mean, literally, whenever I was there. And so they have a year of that. And then they're released into, you know, the great American suburb. I grew up in one. I mean, it's one of the loneliest places on the planet. And I think a lot of what is happening is the depression that ensues from going from a close unified group experience to a solitary experience even if you're in a family, it's still you can be in a family and still not be connected to your community, not feel like you're with your sort of band of brothers. Family is very important, but it can't carry the entire psychological burden for an individual.
After your dear friend Tim Hetherington was killed, you didn't return to conflict journalism. Is that right?
That's correct. Within about an hour after finding out that Tim had been killed in Libya, just about 4 years ago now, I decided to never cover war again for a variety of reasons.
And do you miss it?
I do. I do miss. I don't miss the part of it that I could never quite face at the time, which was how worrying it was to the people I love. I never quite faced it at the time, and it's great to live a life where I'm not doing that to people that I care about. But do I miss the intensity, the sort of meaningfulness, the connection that I had with the guys in the platoon? I mean, I covered lots of wars where I wasn't with the U.S. military. But the last one I covered was with a platoon of U.S. military in eastern Afghanistan. And did I feel like I was part of a tribe? I absolutely. And you know, it's impossible not to miss that. It's such a natural human thing. And if I could magically push a button and go back for a day once in a while and sort of recharge on that feeling, boy, I would do it in a second.
Obviously, I mean, this book is for all of us, but this is your sort of exploration of those emotions, of missing something that you know is dangerous and that nobody can do forever. In terms of the solutions of finding real meaning and community in other places in civilian life, what's the closest thing you have? Does anything compare?
I think to get the intensity and sense of meaning and the necessity of connection that you experience in war, you would have to, unfortunately, find yourself in a kind of catastrophic civilian situation. I live in New York City. 9/11 happened. And in the weeks and even months that followed, there was this extraordinary bond between virtually all New Yorkers. I mean, if you saw someone looking a little sort of dazed and distraught on the street corner, you didn't walk by. You said, "Hey, man, are you all right?" That kind of thing. That's tribalism. I mean, that is what that guy did in Gillette, Wyoming, when he saw me out on the highway. We were taking responsibility for each other, not just physically but emotionally. As a result, the suicide rate went down in New York City after 9/11. I mean, you have a massively traumatized civilian population. You would think that it would lead to such psychological stress that some people would just kill themselves. It's the opposite. The suicide rate went down. The murder rate went down. Violent crime went down. Even Vietnam vets who were suffering from PTSD said that their symptoms went down after 9/11, and it was the same thing. You know, we have neurotics driving ambulances. Like everyone knew they were needed. And when you feel that your people need you, you can overcome. You can ignore and overcome almost any adversity or pain or form of suffering. And that's what we were doing in New York after 9/11. So how do you reproduce that in a wonderful, clean, safe, happy, affluent society that we strive for in America? I don't know if it's psychologically possible. What my book Tribe is trying to do, other than address the very real sort of PTSD issue, which a whole generation of American soldiers is going to have to deal with and that we have to deal with. But other than that, I kind of wanted to get the message out to people. Listen, if you feel like you don't fit in, if you feel like many soldiers do, that you're not connected to anything, like what's your point? What's the purpose of all this? If you feel that way, there's nothing wrong with you. There's something wrong with the society. And when soldiers come back and say that they have a hard time fitting in and they want to go back to war, they're actually having a healthy reaction to a society that is way, way outside of our evolutionary origins and that we're still adjusting to.
You write so beautifully that today's veterans come home to find that although they are willing to die for their country, they're not sure how to live for it, which is to say they come home and they have been in this cohesive unit, and then they find us dividing ourselves along these arbitrary lines over the most ridiculous issues, sometimes important issues, but in ridiculous ways.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not going to tip my hand on what my personal politics are. It's not appropriate as a journalist. But I think I can say that, you know, soldiers go off to fight for their country. And then, and right now in America, they come back to find that their country back home is actually fighting itself. The racial divide, the racial animosity in this country is the worst that I've seen in my lifetime. I'm 54 years old. Economic disparity is bad, and it's getting worse. The political divide is just appalling. We live in segregated communities. We associate with a small group of people and think that other groups aren't somehow legitimate. The use of contempt in political rhetoric right now is incredibly dangerous. I mean, ISIS can hurt us, but they're not a danger to our democracy. Using contempt, the kind of tone you would use against the enemy about your president, your government, about segments of the population, that actually is a threat to our democracy. And so soldiers come back in an environment where none of them are, that I ever saw, are making distinctions of race or income or political belief or religion or anything. If you're willing to die for your brothers, you're good, no matter who you are back home. And then they come back to a country which is obsessed with those differences and actually fighting over them. And I'm not a soldier. I can't speak for them. But I imagine that must be pretty disturbing to them. And you know what? If you come back like that and you think, wow, it was kind of nicer out at Restrepo, I kind of get it.
I want to make it clear that I'm not excusing this kind of divisive behavior. I mean, the whole purpose of what we do on this show is trying to bring people together with ideas. But I wonder if sometimes that really counterproductive factionalism that we see in this country that is, generally speaking, pretty safe and comfortable for a lot of us, if that's actually a maladapted way of seeking tribe, right? If you can declare somebody else the enemy and three people agree with you, then you're building kind of a weird tribe around yourself and your ideas.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a human norm. I mean, warfare and conflict have been part of the human story since the beginning. But it does come down to how we as a country want to define ourselves. As Donald Trump said, you either have a country or you don't. He meant it in a different context, one that I personally don't agree with. But I kind of liked the sentence in a funny way. And I would like to say that back to – well, I'm going to say it. I'd like to say that back to him. Like, if you have a country, then everyone in the country is part of your country, even political leaders you disagree with, even people you are absolutely in opposition to. But they're all in your platoon. And – you know, I can tell you, for all the conflict and complicated, messy emotions that happen in any group of men in any circumstance, particularly in combat, I never heard anyone talk with contempt about someone that was next to him in a trench that they may depend on for their life. I never heard contempt. And what I would say is that I think that really insulting, derisive, contemptuous speech in politics – and in some media figures, that it should go the way of racist speech. I mean, racist speech is protected under the First Amendment, but it is understood to be so destructive to national unity and to our welfare that it's basically you're not allowed to say it in public. And I think that kind of contemptuous speech should be considered in the same category as a really, in some ways, deeply unpatriotic thing to do.
We have a tweet to KERA Think from Chad, who asks a question that you actually address at the top of the book. If symptoms of PTS are natural biological reactions to trauma, does calling it a disorder make sense?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, there's two kinds of PTSD. I obviously use the D for a reason, and I'll explain. There's short-term acute PTSD, which is a completely adaptive reaction to trauma. It helps you survive. If you've been in danger, you want to, for a little while, for a few weeks or months, you want to react to sudden noises. You want to sleep lightly. You want to have nightmares about the thing that could kill you. All of that is a natural and adaptive reaction that you see in most mammals. Long-term chronic PTSD that can continue for years or decades, that's not adaptive. One of the definitions of a disorder is something that keeps you from being able to lead your life. And there are people with chronic PTSD. Something like 20% of people who were traumatized wind up with chronic PTSD. For those people, they do have trouble leading their lives. Some can't leave their homes. That surely qualifies as a disorder, particularly if they've applied for what the government calls disability benefits. I feel like we shouldn't get too caught up in the semantics. It's not a disorder in the short term. It certainly, I think, could qualify in the long term if it's impacting people's lives the way it seems to.
Let's go to the phones now at 800-933-5372. We have Greg on the line in McKinney. Hi, Greg.
Hi, how you doing?
Very well, thanks.
I'm a recently civilianized veteran of the Marine Corps deployed to Afghanistan. And first off, I want to say, Mr. Unger, thanks for all the work you do and all the press you've brought to the military and benefits that have accompanied. Thank you.
Thank you.
One thing that
thank
I
you,
noticed
sir.
In my transition that I think I've struggled with and a reason that a lot of veterans have struggled with is the simplicity of the combat environment and the simplicity of deployment. I was wondering if you could comment on just the mission focus that a lot of veterans have in combat and how they struggle when they come home. Thank you. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call, Greg. We're actually going to take a quick break right now, and we'll get Sebastian's response in just a moment. We are speaking this hour with journalist Sebastian Unger about his new book, Tribe, on homecoming and belonging. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or find the show on Twitter at KERAThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Summer Youth Program with hands-on workshops in game design, coding, robotics, visual arts, math, and language arts for students entering grades K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking with journalist Sebastian Unger about his new book, Tribe, on homecoming and belonging. You can join us at KERA Think or by calling 1-800-933-5372. That's where we heard from Greg before the break, Sebastian, and he brought up, interestingly, the simplicity, ironically, of deployment, of having a military mission to carry out.
Well, again, as an anthropologist, I think I would point out that a platoon in combat is very, very much like the kind of hominid groups that characterize our ancestors and many hunter-gatherer societies. And in those groups, life is extremely simple. I mean, it's collective, it's interconnected, it's face-to-face. You're almost never lonely. I mean, you're almost never without, by yourself. And there are very simple things to do. I mean, there's the necessities of life, water, food, shelter. And so combat reproduces that very, very closely. And we obviously evolved for that. And so when we find circumstances where it's reproduced, it feels right. And sometimes it doesn't feel good, but it feels right. I found a quote from a man who survived an earthquake in Avezzano, Italy, in the early 1900s. And something like 90% of the population of that area was killed. I mean, it was almost like a nuclear strike or something. It was devastating. And the survivors were stuck on their own for days before help got to them. And he said that it instantly turned this highly stratified Italian society into an egalitarian one. And there were no rich people or poor people. They were just people who had to help each other regardless of their origins. And he said and I'm quoting him, he said, an earthquake achieves what the law promises but cannot in fact deliver, the equality of all men. And so if you look at a platoon in combat, there is also this sort of baseline equality where you're judged on your own merits for how you're acting in the moment. And part of that is, you know, is enabled by the great simplicity and importance of the life that you're living.
What have you made of the response to the capture and ultimate return of Bo Bergdahl?
Well, I point out earlier in the book that the kind of damage done by the recession of 2008, the economic collapse that was triggered by a fairly small handful of very powerful, mostly men in New York, mostly in New York City. The equivalent betrayal in a small tribal society would lead to their instant banishment or, frankly, death. And, of course, I'm not suggesting anything. I'm seriously not. But I'm making the point that we've drifted very, very far from our tribal roots when people like that can cause $14 trillion of financial losses to this country. It's something like $45,000 per person that will have to be paid off in the coming decades, that they can cause that kind of damage to this country and with virtually no repercussions for them, much less punishment. I mean, nothing. I mean, there were people who were getting their companies were getting bailed out by the government while they themselves were drawing tens of millions of dollars in a year-end bonus. That's just taxpayer money they're putting in their pockets. So in a tribal society where someone tried to do that, that's not going to end well for them, right? And so what I was pointing out in the very understandable outrage at Sergeant Bergdahl, who walked off of his outpost in Afghanistan and really put a lot of people in jeopardy and may have caused the deaths of some of his fellow soldiers when they were searching for him. That hasn't been confirmed, but anyway, people thought that. And maybe it's true, I don't know. Really understandable outrage at his betrayal. And in my book, I say, you know, if we as a country want to be outraged at that and denounce him as a traitor, that's fine. But don't stop there. I mean, if you're really gonna denounce and punish people who have harmed this country, he hasn't harmed it in any way close to the level that some people on Wall Street did in 2008. So if you want to gear up the outrage, go for it. But don't stop at Bergdahl. You know, keep going until you really are addressing some core issues that have contributed to an enormous amount of pain and suffering in this country. The suicide rate and the unemployment rate are track very, very closely together. They're almost completely parallel. And epidemiologists have pointed out that the 2008 collapse effectively caused the additional suicides of 5,000 people. That's roughly the casualties we have suffered in Iraq and Afghanistan combined. Those people in a tribal society would face severe retribution. In our society, they're not. And that may be another thing that makes soldiers feel like they're coming home to a place that really just they're not that psyched about.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Caleb on the line in Arlington. Hi, Caleb.
Hello. This is my first time calling, long-time listener.
Welcome.
I just want to give my aspect of I'm an Army veteran. I did a combat tour in Iraq. And after I got out of the military, my hardest part of transitioning was losing the support that you have in the military. Whether you had a personal issue with someone, it didn't matter because you didn't have to worry about that person for the most part stabbing you in your back. You know, you knew for a fact that they had your back. You know, the person to the left and right of you had that trust. And getting back in the civilian world, you realize that's not really the case. That support is gone. You know, I got a couple rude awakenings when I first got back and became a civilian. And I want to say that's probably a lot of my friends who also got out, they experienced the same.
Thank you for that. One of the guys that I knew very well out there, Brendan O'Byrne, Sergeant Brendan O'Byrne, we're still very good friends. You know, at one point towards the end of the deployment, he said to me, sort of puzzled, you know, he was like, we're on a hillside somewhere and the mortars were getting shot over our head in an enemy position. We were sitting there chatting, right? And we've been up all night. And he said, you know, it's funny. There's guys in the platoon who straight up hate each other, but we'd all die for each other. Hmm. And, yeah, I think you're exactly right. I mean, the psychological comfort of knowing that is so enormous. And you don't even know it exists until you experience it. And then you do experience it in combat and maybe in some other situations, depending on the life you're leading. And but, so you experience it, and then you kind of can't go back. You know. Once you've had the great security of that kind of relationship to a group of people, civilian life is terrifying. And I think when we've got to figure out how to help a whole generation of young soldiers who are coming back to this country. But we have to figure out what we're trying to figure out. And if we are stuck entirely on the idea of dismantling the effects of trauma, we're going to keep running into dead ends, because I think for a lot of people, they might not have been traumatized, but they're really grieving the loss of closeness and unity and community and tribe that they experienced for the first time over there.
Well, it strikes me that this might also be an unintended consequence of the fact that we have an all-volunteer military now, so that, you know, the vast majority of Americans do not have direct experience with military life, and I would count myself among those individuals. But I would think that people don't typically, you know, sign up for the military because they want a tribe, and this sort of takes them by surprise. But then it's really hard. Your book is taking us there, but it's hard to communicate what the experience of homecoming feels like to people who have not been through it.
Yeah, I mean, the volunteer army versus the draft is a very complicated discussion. But I should say that in World War II, it was a draft army and a massive, massive army, much larger than the one we have now. Similar issues. There's a wonderful movie called The Best Years of Our Lives that shows a group of soldiers returning home from World War II. They'd all seen combat, and they're making their way home. And it's about that process of coming home. And, it looks just as hard back then as it is now. And you realize the title, The Best Years of Our Lives, is not ironic. They're not – the title doesn't mean, oh, they took the best years of our lives from us. The title means the war was – that was the best years of our lives, was the war. And when they pull up in a taxi in front of this guy's house. And he doesn't want to get out. He hasn't seen his family in 3 years. He wants to go to a bar and have one last drink. And his buddies force him out. They're like, come on, man, you got to go home. And he turns to them and says, I feel like I'm about to hit a beach.
Hmm. What do you make of the sentence, the heartfelt sentiment in many cases, thank you for your service?
Well, I'm not a soldier, but I can tell you what other soldiers I know feel about that. I think they feel that it's usually well-intended, that sometimes it's just sort of reflexive and doesn't have a lot of content at all, and that after a certain point, it's almost a little – it doesn't make them feel good. It's almost like it's too easy to dispense with your sort of whatever your civilian responsibility to soldiers and to war is. And don't forget, it's the civilians' war. The soldiers were hired to fight it. It's our war. And that you can't dispense with our collective civilian responsibility for war with a simple sentence. And saying that sentence, it's, I think to some soldiers and veterans, it feels like that's what you're trying to do, and it's really not enough. And frankly, I think – and again, I shouldn't speak for soldiers. I'm guessing here, but I think some of them would probably say, you know, I'd rather have a actual meaningful conversation with you, or, you know, don't say anything at all. I'm good.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Jackie on the line in Dallas. Hi, Jackie.
Hi. Thank you so much for bringing this to light, more so about the tribe mentality and being separated and whatnot. But from someone who is not a soldier or whatnot, but still experiences this sort of dog-eat-dog world in America, and I know that you're more so trying to bring light to that, about how we're tearing each other apart and whatnot, how do you deal with that, not just by bringing that to light, but as an individual saying, hey, I need some help. Hey, I need, like, we need support. We need community here, instead of just going at each other's throats. So going from that to this sort of society.
I see we have about 2 minutes left, and I wish I could solve the nation's problems before the bell goes off. Okay, I would say I'm just going to throw some things out. There isn't an easy fix. It took us thousands of years to get to this point, and we live in a wonderful society, and we don't want to roll it back. It's an amazing, amazing society that we enjoy. What seems to have helped a lot in Israel is national service. I'm morally opposed to making someone fight a war that they're against. But national service could be in any capacity, you know, with a military option, but in any capacity. When I was 18, 19, I wish the nation had said to me, you know, we need you for a couple of years to help build this country, you know, and you're going to be with a bunch of other 18, 19-year-olds, and you might be living in, you know, in a barracks in Montana, rebuilding fences, or in an Indian reservation, or in the Peace Corps in Africa, you know, whatever. But national service, I think, would be a great way of mixing the country racially and socioeconomically, and making young people feel like they're all part of this grand experiment, this incredible thing we're trying to do. I think that gets lost in the sort of iPhone generation. I think that would go a long way towards it. And just the awareness that, I mean, most people drive to where they work, right? They don't work in their community. Some people don't even know their neighbors. And I think there's an enormous psychological, emotional comfort in actually getting to know the people immediately around you in a kind of intimate way. And I don't know how you go about doing that, but just to be aware of it, that there's a real value in feeling close to the people that surround you, like physically surround your home. Like in some sense, those are your people in some definition. And it's worth thinking about and worth pursuing.
How have you built tribe into your own life?
That's another great question. With great difficulty and not entirely successfully. I live in a neighborhood in New York which is extremely familiar and close, and people know each other and help each other. And, you know, at one point I have a car parked on the street, and it's a pretty poor neighborhood actually. And the school crossing guard saw the meter maids coming and waved them off. They were going to write a ticket for my car. The crossing guard knows me and was like waving them off, saying, no, listen, he's coming down. I know he's coming down. He always sits in his car and, you know, whatever, and don't give him a ticket. And they didn't. And there's a little community that includes meter maids. So, you know, it is possible to do it. I you know, but I should say that the most powerful experience I've had with that is overseas, was with American soldiers. And I don't miss getting shot at. I don't miss seeing people get killed. But I miss that connection. And I'm very sad. I don't know if I'll ever really have it again.
Journalist Sebastian Junger is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and author of the new book, Tribe, on homecoming and belonging. Sebastian, it's always a pleasure. Thank you very much for making this time for us.
Thank you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Samantha Guzman is associate producer with help on the phones today from Elizabeth Myung. And our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.